Hello and welcome to today's SNEB Journal webinar. My name is Nick Estrada and I'm the Director of Membership for the Society of Nutrition Education and Behavior. So glad you've joined us for today's presentation. Before we begin, I'd like to review a few pieces of information with you. First, if you look in the GoToWebinar toolbar, you'll see a tab called Handouts. Here you'll find the slides for today. Feel free to download the slides and take notes as you follow along. We'll take questions at the end of the presentation, so throughout, feel free to enter in your question in the questions box. You may also type those in at the end, and they will be moderated out to our presenters. When the webinar ends today, you'll be prompted to complete a short 5-question survey. Please do take a moment to complete that, as your feedback is greatly appreciated both to SNEB and our presenters. Finally, watch for a follow-up email to be sent by the end of the day on Wednesday that will include a link to the recording for today's session, the slide handouts, and your CEU certificate for your attendance today. At this time, I'll now turn it over to our moderator for today, Dr. Kristen DiFilippo from the University of Illinois.
Thank you, Nick. I am happy today to be introducing our speakers. Carolyn Gunther is an assistant professor of human nutrition and extension state specialist at The Ohio State University. Professor Gunther received her PhD from Purdue University in nutrition science. Her research program is dedicated to discovering new knowledge surrounding one of today's most pressing public health nutrition issues, overweight and obesity among underserved children and youth. Specifically, through observational and intervention research, her team is investigating the behavioral and environmental factors, both protective and detrimental, that influence a child's risk for obesity. Findings generated from her work have direct implications regarding federal, state, and local foods and nutrition policy and programmatic reform. Laura Hopkins recently graduated with her PhD in the Ohio State Interdisciplinary Program in Nutrition and a minor in Public Policy and Management. She is currently working as a postdoctoral research scientist at Ohio State University in the Department of Human Sciences and Office of Extension. She received her BS degree in Applied Nutrition from Ohio University and completed her MS degree in Public Health and Dietetic Internship at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She then went on to work as a research coordinator at the Johns Hopkins Global Obesity Prevention Center for almost 2 years. Her doctoral research focused on the issue of summer weight gain in economically disadvantaged, racially minority children in Columbus, Ohio. I want to thank both of them for the time and that they are spending today to share with us their recent article in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, Securing a Stop to the Summer Setback, Policy Considerations for the Future Expansion of the Summer Electronic Benefit Transfer for Children. And at this time, I would like to hand it over to our speakers.
Thank you, Dr. DiFilippo, and also thank you, Nick, for the kind introduction and also for the invitation to present our work. I'm pleased to be here with my colleague, Dr. Laura Hopkins, to share about a little bit about the work that we're doing in our lab. So let's go ahead and get started. I want to note, too, that one of our co-authors on this paper, Dr. Neil Hooker, who's in public policy, is not able to join us, but his contributions were very important to this piece of work. Okay, so before I get into presenting the paper, I wanted to give a little context, a little research context. So my lab is focused on childhood obesity prevention research, as Kristen indicated in the introduction. And specifically, we're looking at several different focus areas. One, we're looking at the protective effect of family meals, healthy family mealtime routines, that is in low-income racial ethnic minority populations. We're also looking at independent eating occasions and pre-adolescent kids, specifically low-income children. And this work here is a collaborative project with colleagues USDA multi-state project. And we're also focused on addressing the problem of unhealthy or inappropriate summer weight gain. And we got into this area of research because within the last 5 to 10 years, there's been emerging data published in the literature indicating that kids, particularly racial ethnic minority children, counterintuitively that they are gaining unhealthy weight during the summer months. And there's been very little work to understand what the environmental and behavioral causes might be. So that gives you some context for how this paper originated. So on this next slide, I'm simply showing you some data that are representative of this trend in unhealthy summer weight gain in disadvantaged school-age children, economically disadvantaged, that is. And this here was published by Von Hippel. It's a large cohort study of children, so the ECLSK cohort. And what's very apparent here is that the summer months, which are indicated right here on the x-axis, that we see that the that there's an increase, almost exponential increase in the slope of BMI or weight status in children, so white, black, and Hispanic. And you can see that the rate of change is most rapid for the black and Hispanic children. And so these were some of the data that inspired us to start addressing this problem here in Ohio. All right, so moving along, there's a little bit of a lag. Okay, so today, Dr. Hopkins, Laura, and I are going to present the paper. It's a special report. It was published in the Nutrition Economics Behavior Special Issue. And so we've structured our presentation today after the outline of the paper itself. So we'll give a little introduction on the problem of food insecurity, particularly in the summer in low-income children. We'll then talk about the underuse and inequitable reach of the USDA Summer Food Service Program and this new electronic, relatively new electronic benefits transfer card program, the SEBTC, as a potential solution to addressing the problem of summer food insecurity in low-income children. And then we'd like to make some, based on the evidence that was generated from this SEBTC demonstration project, and also based on the latest peer-reviewed literature, we'd like to present some policy considerations as this program, this SEBTC program, expands. And then finally, we'll just give some hot off the press updates, legislative updates on the SEBTC program. So to refresh our memory, I wanted to start off by sharing the formal definition, the current formal definition of food insecurity, which here we read is defined as when people do not have adequate access, that's physical, social, or economic access, to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy lifestyle. So this is something that we as nutrition educators know is affecting the populations that we work with in a very real and tangible way. So food insecurity in the U.S., as you know, is a persisting problem. It affects both adults and, unfortunately, children. I say unfortunately with regards to children because, of course, they're in the growth phase of life. And when dietary needs aren't met in childhood during the growth phase, it's very difficult to recover the loss, so health-wise. So here are some current statistics of food insecurity, child food insecurity in the U.S., so in 2015, a little less than 13% of U.S. households were food insecure. And among those households with children, almost 17% were food insecure. And 13 million children were classified as food insecure. So it goes without saying that we have a huge and persisting public health problem in child food insecurity in the U.S. So the government is aware of this problem thanks to the population level survey data, and they've responded by offering federally funded child food and nutrition programs. So I've listed the primary USDA food assistance programs targeted to children. And so we're all very familiar with the with all of these. So we have the school-based program, so that's the National School Lunch Program, and the school breakfast program. So again, these are school-based programs that offer free and reduced cost breakfasts and lunches to eligible children. And then also the summer food service program, which is what we'll be focusing on today. And then we also have the electronic benefit transfer programs, including SNAP and WIC. So these are the, again, the USDA funded and administered programs, food assistance programs targeted to children. So what you may not know is that these children, these programs have been around for a very long time. So Laura and I published a paper a couple years ago describing the history of these child nutrition programs and also looking at their effectiveness in alignment with the current literature. And it was came out of that paper, or one thing that came out of that paper was that the realization that the nutrition standards for the summer food service program are significantly behind their the school-based program. So that's the National School Lunch Program and the School Breakfast Program. So we don't have to belabor this, but I'm in part showing you the history of these programs, which have been around for nearly 75 years, to show that, you know, there has been a very organized and deliberate coordination by the government to address the problem of child food security or insecurity. And unfortunately, this public health problem persists. So again, we'll be focusing specifically in today's presentation on the summer food service program. Okay, so just to refresh your memory or to reorient you, the purpose of the SFSP or the summer food service program is to improve food security during the summer when school is out of session and children lose access to the National School Lunch Program and school breakfast program. And again, this is involves a provision of free meals and snacks to children like the NSLP and the SBP, but at instead of at schools, it's at established SFSP sites, which actually can be schools. And so for a site, for an SFSP site to be eligible, 50% of children at the nearest school must be eligible for free or reduced cost school meals. So let's take a look at how, you know, effective in terms of feasibility outcomes and nutritional health outcomes the USDA SFSP is. So at first glance, so on this next slide, let me back up a little bit. We're looking at the number of SFSP participants per 100 NSLP participants from, you know, 1969 to present. And so at first glance, these data look promising, right? Because there's overall, there's been a general increase in the number of USDA SFSP participants. But if you remember the y-axis here, these numbers are adjusted for or they're relative to the number of NSLP participants. So what you can see very clearly here is that only a fraction of eligible children, children eligible for and participating in the National School Lunch Program, only a fraction of them are participating in the SFSP program. So the implication here is that there our kids going hungry during the summer. So let's also take a look at the number of the statistics about the number of USDA SFSP sites over the same period of time. And again, there's an overall trend, which is encouraging, in the number of SFSP sites established in the U.S. However, well, let me back up a little bit. There's also a number, we've also seen an increase in the number of participants per site. So that's also very encouraging. However, when you look at these data by state, there are huge disparities. And so what we're looking at here is the top ranking and the lowest ranking states in terms of SFSP participants per NSLP, per 100 NSLP participants. So also what spurred us to address this problem in our own laboratory is that Ohio is ranks right at the bottom. And the other thing that I wanted to mention, excuse me, on this last slide is that not only are there huge gaps or disparities in the SFSP participation across states, but there are also huge disparities in participation between urban, suburban, and rural areas. And so the government responded to this problem, and we see that here in the 2010 Agricultural Appropriations Act, where they made it public law to develop and test strategies to address this specific problem of summer food insecurity. And one of the, there were five strategies that were selected to move forward on, and one of these was the Summer Electronic Benefits Transfer Card Program, the SEBTC. So now I'd like to pause and hand over the presentation to my colleague, Dr. Hopkins.
Okay, so now I'm going to dive into more details about the Summer Electronic Benefit Transfer for Children, or the SEBTC program. I'll be reviewing some of the data that we presented in the paper in a little bit more detail, as well as highlighting the policy considerations that we discussed. But before I begin, I'd like to reiterate that the information about this program and the data presented were pulled from the USDA Food and Nutrition Service Summary Report referenced throughout this presentation. We as a lab had no role in the delivery of this intervention or the analysis of the data. The demonstration project is a collaboration between APT Associates, Maximus, USDA FNS, and Mathematica Policy Research. We're merely looking at the data through our lens of the summer hunger and summer health issue, as Dr. Gunther touched on, and we discuss considerations that should be taken with regards to policy moving forward, given what we know about the summertime as a window of risk, as well as other areas of the scientific peer-reviewed literature that relate to this mechanism, this EBT mechanism of intervention. So now to review the SEBTC in more detail. As Dr. Gunther said, this is one of several programs that were tested to address the issue of summer hunger and the disparities that exist in different geographic regions. The SEBTC was a demonstration project to examine the use of electronic benefits as a way to protect against child food insecurity during the summer months. It was tested from 2011 to 2014. And families were considered eligible if one child in pre-K through 12th grade was considered eligible for the National School Breakfast and Lunch programs. Additionally, families had to reside in one of the site areas, which are going to be detailed on the next slide. So there were two mechanisms of intervention that were tested during these demonstration years. First was the amount of money distributed. So they looked at either a $30 distribution and a $60 distribution, comparing it to $0 or no distribution. And additionally, the sites were able to choose the type of electronic benefit model that was utilized, so either a SNAP model or a WIC model. And these models really mirrored the national program, so SNAP and WIC, with regards to food restrictions, where the SNAP model had minimal food restrictions in terms of what participants could and could not purchase, whereas the WIC model, the sites developed packages of items that could be purchased with benefit money. They also mirrored these programs in terms of what happens to the benefits that were not used up. So at the end of the month with the SNAP model, if benefits weren't used, they could be rolled over to the next month, whereas in the WIC model, the benefits expired at the end of the month. Now, this did vary from site to site. Each site kind of created different rules, but generally these two models followed the national programs. So then on this slide, you see table one from our paper. This is an overview of the testing year, so 2011 to 2014, as you see in the first column. The distribution amounts that were tested in each of those years. So one thing you'll see is that the $30 benefit was never compared directly to the $0 benefit. And this table, what else you see in this table is the site grantees and the number of sites. The different models that were used, so the SNAP versus WIC, the approximate number of children and households participating, and the aim of the analyses each year. It wasn't the same every year. So 2011 was really the first pilot. So I'll again reference you and direct you to the USDA FNS website as a summary report and a full report for each year are available. So you can see here that states that have participated in the project include Connecticut, Michigan, Missouri, Oregon, Texas, Delaware, Nevada, and Washington, as well as two American Indian nations. And so now I'll start going through some of the data with regards to participation, food security, and dietary intake. Throughout this presentation and in our paper, we presented data only comparing the two benefit amounts explored. So again, that $30 versus the $60 benefit. Several additional publications are available from the agencies that performed the intervention and the analyses, exploring the data much more in depth and specifically comparing the SNAP versus WIC models. We will touch on that a little bit at the end of the presentation, but we refer you to those publications as well. So in terms of participation, which is defined as having redeemed the benefits at least once throughout the summer, participation across both the $30 and $60 benefit was very similar. So looking at 89% to 90% for both of those. And redemption, or the total amount of benefits used across households, was about 76%. And per the summary report, when looking at the 2013 and 2014 years, it appears that the participation rate and the exhaustion rate, so the exhaustion rate being complete use of all benefits, were similar across both the $30 and $60 groups, but the benefit redemption rate was a little lower in the $30 group. However, when looking at the year 2013 alone, benefit exhaustion rate was greater in the $30 group. So overall, participation, redemption, and benefit exhaustion rate were pretty similar between the $30 and $60 group, with some differences between specific years, but overall were very similar when looking at the data together. So then looking at this slide, we are looking at food security. And so I wanted to show you that really they were looking at all types of food security. So in children, in adults, and in household food security. In this table, we're looking at the $60 benefit group compared to the $0 benefit group. And you can see that food security was significantly better for children, adults, and households with the $60 benefit. In this slide, we're looking at just the child food security data slightly differently, more graphically. And we can see that very low food security and food insecurity in children were significantly more impacted by the $60 benefit compared to the $0 benefit group. And then similarly on this slide, again, we're only looking at food security or insecurity among children, comparing the $30 to the $60 benefit group. And we see that there's a significant impact in food insecurity in children comparing the $60 group to the $30 group with a p-value of less than 0.01, and a marginally significant improvement in the very low food security group in children comparing the $60 benefit to the $30 benefit. Now, again, as I said before, there wasn't a year that directly compared the $30 benefit to the $0 benefit. So any analyses comparing those two groups were calculated quasi-experimentally. But we see similar trends across all of the food security data from this report in that there is a very linear trend in all food security groups, with the greater the benefit amount, the greater food security was protected. Except in that very low food security group in children, we don't see as linear of a relationship, but still some marginally significant impacts. And then moving on to the nutritional diet quality outcomes. So dietary intake was assessed using a survey module designed to assess children's dietary quality relative to the 2010 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Food frequency questions were developed by the National Cancer Institute for the 2009-2010 NHANES multi-factor diet screener, and their scoring algorithms were the same ones used or that was what was used for this demonstration project. And here we see first comparing the $30 and $60 benefit to the $0 benefit. Children significantly ate more fruits and vegetables, whole grains and dairy products, and less added sugars, excluding cereals and sugar-sweetened beverages. And then when comparing that $30 benefit to that $60 benefit, children ate significantly more fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. So in summary, we know that the Summer Food Service Program is a highly underutilized program, as Dr. Gunther touched on earlier in this presentation, just in comparison to the other child food assistance programs that are out there, such as the school breakfast and lunch programs. And this led the federal government to funnel money into projects to improve child food security during the summer months, with the SEBTC being one of those projects. And as we just reviewed by looking at some of the data that are presented in the summary reports, the SEBTC program really shows great promise in terms of successful engagement of participants, improvements in food security, and improvements in diet quality. So therefore, there has been, or we have seen, continued support from the federal government to continue and expand this program, and I'll touch on some of those. So the first being under President Obama's administration, we saw the Stop Child Hunger Act of 2015 introduced into Congress and the House. And this bill proposed a single $150 distribution of benefits per child per household during the summer. However, the last action taken on that was in November of 2015, when it was referred to the Subcommittee on Early Childhood Elementary and Secondary Education. So while that seems to, you know, have stalled a little bit, or appears to have at this time, the program has continued to be a part of the federal budget. So in 2016, President Obama proposed $12 billion over 10 years in his 2017 budget to allow or to provide child meal eligible families to receive $45 per child through EBT each month that the school is out of session. And I just want to bring your attention to that $45 amount, because that's different than what had been tested in the SEBTC program. So we looked at both a $30 and a $60 amount, and this appears to just really be right in the middle of that. And I will come back to that when we talk about our policy considerations. And then just as this proposal in the budget continued, it was approved in the House in April of 2016, and then finally approved by the Senate in May of 2016. And I just copied that language down there in the final appropriations bill, that $23 million would remain available to continue the Agricultural Appropriations Act of 2010, which is, of course, the bill that we talked about at the beginning that introduced the SEBTC program and the other projects to address the issue of child food security in the summer. So given the success of the SEBTC program, the continued support by the federal government, and what we know about child health during the summer months, we looked at these data and what was going on in the federal government and noted a few policy considerations moving forward. The first being the benefit amount, and really suggesting $60 per child per family. And this is based on the data that we presented here today, where we really see that $60 benefit amount leads to the best outcomes in terms of food security and nutritional health. We did see benefits in the $30 amount as well, but we definitely saw greater benefits in the $60 amount. And as I said, you know, some government actions that have gone forward are referencing a different amount, such as that $45, which is fine, but we recommend if that is what is going to be pushed forward, that testing needs to be done to really compare that $45 amount to that $60 amount. And then our second consideration is conducting a cost-benefit analysis of a single versus bi-monthly, so twice a month distribution of the SEBTC funds. And this consideration is derived from what we know about not only child food security during the summer, but also what we know about child health. So again, going back to that focus of our lab here, the child weight increases during the summer months. We see other health indices decline during the summer months. So knowing that and also paralleling that to a growing body of literature on the health ramifications of a single distribution, so single distribution of funds through programs like SNAP or WIC, and how this leads to cyclical spending. And this was also reviewed in our paper. And here's a slide, you know, briefly going over this. And at the time when we published this paper, we had identified 12 studies that examined the impact of the disbursement of SNAP benefits through EBT and how it related to diet quality, behavioral outcomes, incidence of hypoglycemia. And the findings are, you know, there's a lot of negative findings. Again, it leads to this cyclical spending, utilization of different, more unhealthy retail channels with less healthful foods, a decreased consumption of food at the end of the month, lower healthy eating index scores in terms of diet quality at the end of month, higher intake of cholesterol at the beginning of the month. You know, we see that people go to the grocery store, spend a lot of or all of their benefits for various reasons at the beginning of the month. So they purchase highly processed shelf-stable foods that are just lesser in diet quality. We see more hypoglycemic hospital admissions at the end of the month and more disciplinary incidents at school among children. So this, again, is really where our second consideration comes from, is just thinking about these programs that are already out there that are using electronic benefit technology and what we can learn from them to promote the most helpful and useful programs moving forward.
Okay, thank you, Laura. So I'd like to keep talking about policy considerations. So the policy considerations that Laura presented on the previous slide were considerations presented in the paper. And what I'd like to do here is to present some additional policy considerations that we didn't address directly in the paper that we published. And also just as a side note, why are these policy considerations so important? It's to ensure optimization of the program, that the program achieves what it's intended to achieve. So additional policy considerations using the SNAP versus the WIC model. So in the SEBTC demonstration project, what did they find? In terms of feasibility outcomes, the participant rates for SNAP and WIC models were fairly equal, high and fairly equal. SNAP was a little bit higher. However, the exhaustion rate for SNAP was significantly higher than it was for WIC. There were no differences between delivery models in food security. And in terms of nutritional impacts, the WIC model was twice as great as the SNAP model. So the point, one thing to note too is that when you look at the data in the peer-reviewed literature, these data mirror that. So we see that the exhaustion rate of SNAP benefits is higher than WIC, and that could be due in part, it's likely due in part, to the fact that there are less rules and regulations surrounding what foods can be purchased on a SNAP benefit versus the WIC benefit, which is delivered as a bundle. On the other hand, the WIC model or the WIC program has demonstrated to have a better nutritional impact than the SNAP model. And again, that might be due to the fact that the WIC model is very prescriptive in nature, whereas the SNAP model, there's a great deal of free choice in what participants can choose. So these are that's one additional policy consideration and moving forward. Another policy consideration is to assure that these two federal food assistance or electronic these food assistance programs, right, that are both designed to address child hunger during the summer months, that they're working in concert and not competition. And part of the reason why we're stating that as a policy consideration is that there were some data from the demonstration project that there was a type of, you might call cannibalization of the SABTC program on the SFSP program. So by that, I mean that there was a hint of data showing that in places where they offered the SABTC program that participation rates in the SFSP went down. And so we want kids and families getting healthy foods during the summer months through both of these programs. But the SFSP program offers so much more, meaning access to, daily programming, safe play. And so that's another consideration, is to make sure that these two programs are working in a collaborative way. So where are things today? So there are, since we published our paper, there have been, these were the 2016 grantees listed here. Many of them were grantees in the prior years of the demonstration project. We've also seen an expansion of the program to more rural areas and more extreme need areas. And our last slide here, we simply wanted to give you an update, a real-time update, that the current administration has recommended not only continuation of the SFSP program at a rate of $520 million, which is a decrease from the year prior, but that's only due to the issue of carryover funds. But they've also recommended a continuation of funding of the SEBTC program, and almost $23 million represents an increase from the year prior. So that concludes our presentation, and we welcome your questions at this time.
So if you have questions, please type those into the question box now, and I would be happy to share those with our presenters. One question that I have, I was wondering, what frequency of distribution of funds would you recommend to avoid some of the negatives of cyclical spending?
So some that have been hypothesized or, looked at in the literature is a bimonthly distribution, so twice a month, to really avoid that cyclical spending as opposed to once monthly.
Thank you. Another question is, could you suggest some ways to increase collaboration between the SFSP and the SEBTC programs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think one way of better marrying or assuring that the two programs are working in collaboration, that's a tough question. You know, I think the schools can play a huge role in increasing participation in the SFSP program. We know that, and that's in part why there's the seamless summer option in place now. But I think, you know, if the same message, you know, came from, or the message came from the same place, that is schools, that there was this other program and helping families, you know, educating families in how to utilize both maximally might be one mechanism for doing so, or for making sure that they're working together.
Yeah, and to add on to that, at least with the summer food service program, each state has a state agency that, you know, is on the hierarchy of executing the summer food service program. And so in Ohio here, it's the Ohio Department of Education, and it varies from state to state. But just mirroring messages and I guess making sure we're advertising both programs collectively. And I think a lot of it would fall on the state agency, but also support from other stakeholders, you know, throughout the states to make sure families are aware of both programs. And then, you know, other things, you know, something that comes to mind, and I think Dr. Gunther was touching on this as well, is, you know, some of these SEBTC sites are choosing a WIC model over a SNAP model. Well, a WIC model takes a little bit more education because of restrictions in purchasing and things like that. So then using maybe the summer food service program as an outlet or a place where education about the WIC modeled SEBTC program and packages and what you can and cannot purchase with that, with those benefits. So those are just some examples that come to mind.
Thank you. Another question is, what do you believe are some of the reasons there is more insecurity and weight gain over the summer among the children who are eligible?
Yeah, so there aren't a lot of published studies, and I might venture to say there are no published studies looking at, you know, in a longitudinal way at the direct causes for food insecurity and unhealthy weight gain during the summer months. The hypothesis is, and this is intuitively obvious, is that the school has a protective effect. And so low-income children who don't have the same resources of all kinds as their non-low-income counterparts, you know, when they lose access to schools during the summer months, that it's, you know, it's sort of like a free-for-all. They lose access to healthy daily foods, physical activity, structure. And so that's the primary hypothesis. And the structured day hypothesis is really emerging in terms of its influence on a child's health behaviors and their health outcomes.
Thank you. Another question, where do the children receive the summer meals? What kinds of locations, such as is this in schools? And then also, how do the children get there?
The sites can be pretty much anything. They can range from churches to libraries to schools to recreation centers. A site has to find a sponsor being someone that would provide food. So an example here in Columbus, Ohio, Columbus City Schools often sponsors or Columbus City Food Service Program, Columbus City Schools Food Service Program, often sponsors, and in collaboration with Columbus Rec and Parks Department, sponsors different sites. So when those sites are established at schools or recreation centers, so it really can be anywhere a site can establish themselves. The definition is that the nearest school to wherever your physical location of where you want to establish the site has to service 50% students with who are eligible for free or reduced cost school breakfast and lunch meals. In terms of how kids get there, that is one of the major barriers to participation.
Yeah, and in fact, that is one of the rationale for developing and offering the SCBTC program. Because transportation, particularly for kids living in rural areas, is a huge issue. So there is no transportation offered. There's no transportation that accompanies the SFSP program. So kids are expected to get to sites on their own, or with the help of a caregiver. That is a major issue that you've the transportation is a major issue that you've touched on. And one trend that's happening locally in Franklin County and then across the state of Ohio is food trucks. So taking the foods to the places where kids are spending their summer days. Of course, there's all sorts of pros and cons to that, but there are other, in addition to the SCBTC program, there are other good and creative ideas for overcoming the transportation barrier.
When that is going on, when caregivers are transporting people there, is food provided for the caregivers or for younger siblings who aren't school age?
So in terms of children, they don't have to be school age. It's anyone under the age of 18 is eligible for the meals, and slightly higher age range too if there are special needs involved. And in terms of the caregivers, that is something that is being tested, I know at least in Ohio, up in Cleveland, and I think across the country as well, is providing meals to the parents, either free, and usually if they're being provided for free, it's because the school or the county or whoever is administering the program has received some sort of local grant to kind of test this, or at a very cheap rate, providing meals to the parents as well.
Okay. Another question is, how frequently do you believe that people actually had leftover money month to month, since the literature said there is food left over by the third week? And is it state to state that money is rolled over, or is that at a federal level?
Yeah, that level of detail of the data, to our knowledge, have not been published from the group that did the primary evaluation. I'm not aware of that.
Yeah, and I don't think the data are publicly available yet either.
No, they're not. They're not.
Okay. I believe that is all the questions we have for today. I want to thank you so much. I know this was very informative for me, and I appreciate the time you both spent on this. And at this time, I can hand it back over to Nick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen, and thank you again to our presenters. We really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us. Just a couple reminders for everybody as I close out today's session. First, when you leave today, you will get a short 5-minute or 5-question survey. Please do take a moment to fill that out. Watch for an email on Wednesday, which will include today's recording, the handouts for today, and your CEU certificate. And if you enjoyed today's Journal Club webinar, be sure to sign up for our last couple. Our next one is April 9th at 12 p.m. Eastern. Thanks so much and have a great day.